You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 66 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And this is the podcast we have been waiting for a full year.
Maybe even more than that. We've been waiting so long to do a Seafair cast.
Seafair Pelton Cast.
And we have to celebrate a special Seafair beer here with us.
we have two beers this week because we're still drinking through Sierra Nevada's beer camp across the world. But I purchased this beer well before we even had the Sierra Nevada beer camp. And that is from Pike Brewing Company, Pike Seafair Summer Ale.
That sounds delicious.
Say summer in Seattle at Seafair, creating memories and uniting communities since 1950. 10 weeks, 75 events, 2 million people. Drink summer in Seattle with Pike's Seafair Summer Ale.
Since 1950, that's how long our grandparents started going. Sadly, our grandfather no longer mobile enough to get out to Seafair at age 95. But suffice it to say, he's been around for all.
Sitting on a hill for like 8 hours.
No, that's not really conducive for him.
So we're going to be drinking that Pike Seafair Summer Ale in just a little bit, but I think we're going to do our beer camp beer of the week before then.
Yeah, we'll start with that.
And that this week is going to be the Beer Camp Ginger Lager, brewed in collaboration with Surly Brewing Company. Do you want to read about that one?
The abrasive attitude of Minnesota's Surly Brewing Company. I kind of thought that was a foreign one at first, and it was like, you know, like Surrey or something.
But Surly Brewing Company.
Brings an aggressive yet refined approach to creating recipes. We came together to create this easy drinking but complex ginger-infused lager. It's brewed with hot ginger and a pinch of cayenne to spice up the heat, and then dry hopped with an inclusion of oak for a touch of woody vanilla to round out the flavor. Did we have we had this previously, right?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
In the side beer camp 12 pack that I got.
That's right. You got to have two beer camp 12 packs. That's the only way to do it. There is no other way. That's
for recreational drinking.
Yes. As opposed to this, our professional drinking. It's definitely very gingery. It tastes like ginger beer. Except it's actual beer.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's my review.
I'm in on that.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
I've always wanted ginger beer to have alcohol in it.
Should we toast? Because we've got some exciting news here tonight.
Oh, a special toast.
It is. A toast to our first live Pelton cast. We are proud to announce that we are having the long-anticipated live show, and we will be hosting it on Tuesday, September 5th at Vermilion in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood.
Are we going to have any special guests at this live show?
We are going to have a special guest. We're thrilled to be joined by Danny Kelly of The Ringer, who will help us preview the Seahawks season. That'll be the week before the start of the NFL season, two nights before the opening game on Thursday night, and five nights before the Seahawks open the season by losing at Green Bay. And we will also talk about preview the
open the season losing at Green Bay because of a Kevin King interception.
Yeah. We will also talk about Husky football. They'll have opened up the previous week at Rutgers. And
most importantly,
we will be crowning Seattle's best burger. The finals of that competition will be held live at this show after we go through the quarterfinals starting this week and then the semifinals.
Wow! I cannot believe this is actually happening. How can people get tickets to this event?
So the event is free, first off. It's important to note. We'll start at 7 p.m. I assume doors at like 6:30. We haven't talked about this previously. It seems reasonable.
Sure.
It's free, but so we have an idea of how many people are going to come and so that you can guarantee yourself a seat, since seating will be somewhat limited in Vermilion. We're asking everyone to go get free tickets. And how can they do that?
Tomorrow, tickets go on sale. They're free, but I call it on sale. Right.
That's Wednesday.
I work in the business.
It's almost certainly today as you're listening to this. It's tomorrow as we're recording.
Tickets go on sale Wednesday, August 2nd at 12 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. You're going to tweet out the link from the Pelton Cast, but you can also go to peltoncast.brownpapertickets.com for tickets.
Or the link will also be on the post note on soniccentral.com/peltoncast. Plenty of options to do this, but
space is very limited, though. I would highly recommend, if you're interested in going to this event, going and getting those tickets quickly.
We're not going to turn anyone away at the door, but like I said, this is how you can guarantee that you have a seat. Also important to note, Vermilion has a bar.
Vermilion has a bar, and they serve Rainier Tallboys, And we're like two blocks away from Dick's.
It's more than two blocks away from Dick's. I mean, we basically walked that at Capitol Hill Block Party a couple weeks ago. It was no, it's substantially more than two blocks.
Okay.
But we're in the general vicinity of it. We'll see whether Dix is in the final as part of that competition.
I would not hold my breath if I were
Dix. We will also plan to have a get-together at some local bar after the show so that we can hang out with you guys further. But we're so thrilled.
Just you.
You, the listener.
So we can hang out with you. Be prepared to have a lot of one-on-one time with us. One-on-two time, the listener and us.
We're so excited, but we've been talking about this for months, and excited to make it a reality.
Is Danny Kelly going to be the third Pelton brother for the championship?
So he's been non-committal via email. Maybe if he listens to this pod, he'll...
He's been non-committal via email?
You know, I mentioned it at one point, the burger competition, and then he didn't reply to that.
He was not interested.
We've got still a month to figure this out.
I'm so, to pressure him into being the third Pelton brother. So curious to find out what his burger credentials are.
You gotta find out about burger credentials. Should we go directly into that and now start the quarterfinals?
Oh, I'm so excited.
All right, well, it's time to kick off the quarterfinals of our search for Seattle's best burger. And to help us do that, we welcome in our first honorary third Pelton brother, coming back from last week for a repeat appearance, Chris Smith. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks. 2 weeks in a row. I'm very honored.
Yeah, back. You're the first guest to go back to back.
Wow. Put me in the books. Probably the first guest to drink champagne in the back of a car while recording a podcast as well.
Not just first, but only on the podcast. Although we did have, I think we also had champagne on the post-Super Bowl pod as well. With
we're not in the back of a car, though.
That definitely, we're not there. We've done in the past. Do you want to talk about your burger credentials?
Me?
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a lot of burgers. So I don't know what that is.
All right, that seems fair.
I've had burgers in at least probably 4 or 5 states.
Oh, wow. That's more states than I've had. That's more states than I've been to.
Now I'm trying to think how many states I've had burgers in. It's definitely Washington, California, Nevada, Oregon. Not sure if there's any else.
You're just naming states now.
It's on the West Coast.
Massachusetts, Al, have you had a burger in Massachusetts?
I don't think I've ever had a burger when I've been in Boston. It would be an odd thing for me to get in Boston, I guess I would say.
So you've got some pretty impressive burger credentials here.
So we kind of talked a little bit about Loretta's last week on the pod. Is there anything else for us to say besides how amazing Loretta's is?
I don't think so. I don't think there's much more you can say.
Okay, we've said a lot about Loretta's on this podcast. So you went to Great State. Was this your first time at Great State?
First time ever.
Great State, the number 8 seed here against the heavy favorite, number 1 seed, Loretta's. Your first time there, what did you think?
I was pleasantly surprised.
Oh.
It was a lot better than I thought it was going to be, for sure.
I mean, they reached the Elite Eight.
They have Rainier tall cans, so that's always a plus.
That is a plus. I mean, I feel like Great State is like quickly becoming a thing. When we went in, what was that? That was March, I guess? It was right after St. Patrick's Day.
Wow, we've been searching for Seattle's best burger since March?
We've been searching since February. We started the week after the NBA All-Star game was when we went to...
We've eaten a lot of burgers.
Yeah.
And now we're going back.
I've been waiting my whole life for this search.
Yeah, we're re-upping now. So when we went there in March, they had 2 locations. Now they have 3 open, a 4th at Safeco Field, and a 5th that
Safeco
is on the way.
Field?
They are
How prolific.
They are very
prolific. Who are they, me with children?
But yeah, I mean, I feel like there's eventually going to be more locations of Great State than there are Dick's. And I mean, actually, I guess that would be very hard. There's not that many Dick's around. So it could be like Seattle's most populous local burger chain, excepting local burger chain Red Robin.
Okay, so you were pleasantly surprised. What were some general thoughts that you had about the burger, Chris?
I thought it was very well put together. Nice presentation.
What did you go with? Did you go with the single or the double?
Double, of course.
Me too. Yeah.
So I would note that we discussed this in our original review. I had the double last time, and I felt like it was too much meat because of how thoroughly they cook the patties. This time I went with the single, and I enjoyed it much more.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was just a much more flavorful experience, and it allowed the cheese, which is the clear standout here, to really shine.
It's a pretty good burger, right? I think that Great State is the most underrated burger that we've had in the entire search.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
I just think,
you don't think it's highly rated?
I really don't think it is. It's like,
I mean, they keep expanding. Some people must like the spur.
It seems like they're expanding not because people love Great State, but because maybe they have capital. Like, it's not like they're expanding out of necessarily out of demand.
And Kevin Alexander had them rated pretty highly. I'm gonna have to go look where he had them on his list. But
so the thing that I think about, Chris, is it seems like it's definitely In-N-Out inspired.
Yeah, for sure. Especially just having had In-N-Out last month, it definitely reminded me of that a lot.
Where do you think it ranked in terms of the In-N-Out that you had last month?
So it's obviously not like an animal style thing that they have there at Great State. But I thought it was a little bit more neat, and it kind of reminded me of this taco place I've been to in Maui that the chef guy is like insists on walking around and telling everyone it's like 13 separate ingredients, you know, just like put together just right.
Huh.
I think they just put it together nicely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nice visual. It was, by the way, it was number 4 in Kevin Alexander's list of Seattle's best burgers on Thrillist, which I believe therefore was number 3 of the burgers that we considered, because he also had the cheeseburger from Two Bells Bar and Grill, which was not eligible for our competition.
Because we read that story. Don't order burgers at restaurants.
I mean, it's a bar. I think that's okay to order them there. But so it was behind Unita and of course Loretta's. So I think it's well rated. The cheese is just surprisingly flavorful somehow. I don't know how they pull that off, but it is excellent.
We're giving all this love to Great State. I'm excited. So first up, let's go to the fan vote. You put up a poll on Twitter, and what did the fan vote come back as?
Well, I still want to say one last thing on Great State, which is that I put it in the 8th spot over places that we had collectively rated higher.
I wanted Feed Company to be the number 8 burger.
And I think I had 206 Burger Company rated higher, but I wanted to put it 8th because of the fact that A, it's growing so quickly and there's a lot of buzz, and B, I thought that I would enjoy it much more the second time around. And I was correct in that assessment. I also added the raw onions. I think that was a nice touch to it.
Oh.
Yeah.
I went with the grilled.
You went with grilled onions? I don't even know if I saw this on the menu.
It's definitely on the menu online. They say that they'll offer you that option. And I was specifically asked it by the cashier. So I appreciated that since I didn't see it on the menu in the actual. I went to the International District location, which, by the way, it is wrong to have a burger place in the International District. I just want to say that.
Yeah. Okay. I went to the Laurelhurst, and I definitely saw the onion thing on the menu.
Huh. And I went to the downtown location. We all went to different Great State locations.
None of us went to the Safeco Field location.
I unfortunately have not been to Safeco Field all season.
So anyway, my takeaway is this is one of Seattle's 8 best burgers.
Okay.
That is my conclusion here. So I think it merited entry. So as you mentioned, the fan poll, we had this on the @PeltonCast Twitter. Keep a lookout for that. Follow us @PeltonCast if you haven't already. We had a grand total of 16 votes from the listener. The listener voted many times. But
not that many times.
And Loretta's got 81% of the vote to Great State's 19%, which I believe means they got 2 votes, 3 votes, 13-3. Yeah.
Okay. So, Chris, as the first third Pelton brother, where did you go in this first round matchup?
You know, I would just want to say first that I would probably pick Great State over Dick.
Oh,
wow. That is a hot take.
But the Redder's Tavern burger is so freaking good. It's not going down.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a queen sweep for Loretta's here.
It really was a tough matchup for Great State. I think, you know, I've looked at the matchups and every single one of the Elite Eight, and I think we could have a lot of upsets, but this one, Great State didn't stand a chance. They were a very strong 8 seed, but you can't compare to the Tavern burger. They're the overall number 1.
Yes.
So I went Tavern burger, not in a landslide, though. It was close.
I still went Tavern burger in a landslide. Tavern burger's the best. So next week, we move along to our next quarterfinal. I believe we're going to do the 2-7 matchup, which will be Lil Woody's against Swinery Meats.
You know, I've had Swinery one time, but it was maybe like 4 years ago after reading a Seattle magazine thing about Seattle's best burgers.
I encourage you to try it again. They're a real contender for 2-7 upset to me.
I barely remember it, but I know it was good.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it's really going to come down to just whether the third Pelton brother next week likes cloth napkin burgers or paper napkin burgers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What about compostable? That's a real Seattle burger.
That is. I guess that falls under the paper napkin category. All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us again this week, Chris. And serving is the first third Pelton brother. A great honor.
I am very honored.
Thank you.
All right. Well, no surprise there. Loretta's moving on. Thanks again to Chris Smith for joining us is the third pillar. Now we continue and talk about sports. There's a lot to talk about this week. Do you want to start with the Seahawks?
Let's start with the arena first. Basically, Seattle, King County voted today, right?
Yes. Today, as we record this, the primary elections in Seattle and King County. Plenty of things up for election, most notably the mayor of Seattle. And the results, the first round of results.
I have no idea. You're the news to me right now. You're Dan Lewis.
Yeah, the first round.
You're Steve Rabel.
Yeah, let's go with Steve Rabel, with all due respect to Dan Lewis. The first round of results came in at 8:15 p.m. tonight. And in the mayoral election, Jenny Durkin with 31.6% of the vote.
Okay, Durkin's in.
Yes, fulfilling my prediction that no matter what else happened, that she would get through as one of the two finalists to the general election in November. And the second spot, still to be determined, the surprising leader so far, Carrie Moon, with 15.5% of the vote, followed by Nikita Oliver, the far-left progressive candidate, with 13.9%. Still, I think, you know, a strong chance that she ends up surpassing Carrie Moon when all of the male votes
How
are counted.
How far back was she?
She's 1.6% back. And then in fourth place, another of the female contenders for mayor, Jessen Farrell, at 11.8%. Nowhere to be found among the leaders. Mike McGinn,
who seems
almost certain, have a chance to reclaim mayor after, you know, holding that office previously. So
he was lucky to be mayor one time. We should all be so lucky.
It is kind of surprising in hindsight that he was ever mayor. He was on the Seattle Growth podcast. They've had a couple new episodes, one in interview, a sit down with him, and then also this week a discussion about, you know, the financial impact of the arena and then also the city budget. So I recommend listening to that one in particular. The McGinn episode, a little dated now, but like at the end he was like, any closing thoughts? And he was like, yeah, I guess I should stump for people to vote for me for mayor now. It's like, yeah, that's kind of what you should do.
Okay, so a couple quick questions about Mike McGinn not moving on in the primary. First, this is not a question, but I follow the McGinn for Mayor Facebook, and they kept going live throughout the day, and like six people were watching it, and how I knew he was not moving on.
No.
I was like, this is not happening. So I guess first off, what does it mean, assuming Jenny Durkin is probably an overwhelming favorite to be elected mayor come November?
I think so. Certainly she has the funny advantage. She is the favorite of the political powers that be.
She's almost the incumbent in a way.
Yes. You know, getting the nomination from Ed Murray, although that now is somewhat loaded with the allegations against him and continued calls for him to step down. Now a second council member, Sawant, has asked for his resignation, although still not nearly enough to actually oust him from the office. I think she's the favorite. I don't know how overwhelmingly she is favored, because the one thing we will see, and we talked about this before, is whichever of the other candidates got through with Jenny Durkin was going to pick up the progressive vote.
Okay.
So, you know, if you combine Carrie Moon and Nikita Oliver, combine their votes, all of a sudden, now you're getting pretty close to Jenny Durkin's votes.
Interesting.
In the early voting. And the general sense is that I don't want to call it absentee, because so it, for those of you who aren't local, all voting in the state of Washington now is by mail or by Dropbox. There are no actual, you know, polls that you go to on the day of the election. So it does take longer for them to, you know, come up with the results. And I guess the sense is that people who vote early
people vote early.
Yeah, and maybe people who vote late tend to be more progressive. So that's why, one of the reasons why, besides just, you know, the statistical randomness in the early results, why Nikita Oliver is still given a pretty good chance of advancing through. But anyway, if you combine there too, you get pretty close to Jenny Durkin's votes. I don't know that that's necessarily the right way to predict the election, but I give whoever comes out of that group a decent chance.
Okay, you're gonna have to turn into the local Nate Silver for in the coming months, but
definitely have considered that. The local data though is rough.
you're gonna have to maybe do more than the local Nate Silver. You're gonna actually have to be running the polls. But
we'll use the Appel guest Twitter.
16 people will vote.
Such a robust sample.
I think the At Boundcast Twitter probably would be much more in favor of McGinn. So I guess two questions. What does Jenny Durkin mean for an arena in Soto versus Key Arena renovation?
So as we talked about a few weeks ago, both Moon and Oliver have come out in favor of the Key Arena option. I don't know that in either case that's a strong enough held opinion that it couldn't be changed by learning more about the issue. And,
or that necessarily what the mayor thinks matters.
That's also what we should talk about, which is this whole decision could be done by the time the mayor takes office. The expectation is that the city council will vote on, you know, if they decide to take the Key Arena option, that they would vote on that in early December, as soon as the memorandum of understanding with Chris Hansen's group expires. If they instead decide to approve the street vacation for the Chris Hansen Soto group, the vacation of Occidental Avenue, they could do that even earlier, as early as a couple months from now.
Interesting.
So who like, the mayor does matter to some extent in terms of the political clout, and that was something McGinn mentioned in his interview, as he talked about, you know, that Ed Murray did not support the street vacation, and he figured that that was one factor in it getting voted down the past time. But ultimately, it's not a huge thing. And certainly, I would say, for these progressive candidates, the arena is not a key core issue for them, something that there's a major concern for them. Durkin, as we talked about at that point, was noncommittal on either option. So she's still something of a wild card. I mean, I think, you know, her ties to Ed Murray do suggest that she's probably somewhat more likely to ultimately favor the Key Arena option, but we really don't know.
Okay, so also, what does it mean that Mike McGinn, during this campaign, tied himself to a Soto Arena and NBA basketball through the entire campaign and has been widely rejected here today?
Yeah, it means that at best 7.2% of the population really feels strongly in favor of the Soto Arena.
It didn't feel like the best plan to me.
I thought it might be successful for him just because of the fact that A, the turnout is so low, and B, the field is so divided that having one issue that, you know, you reliably got a block of voters with would help you. But that turns out not to be the case. I was wrong about that.
But do you think that means anything for Soto versus Key Arena? Because it feels to me like the typical progressive candidate is going to look at it and say, we can solve this problem right now with Key Arena.
Yes.
By making an arena in Soto, and also not necessarily as attached to basketball, but by making an arena in Soto, you're just creating another problem.
I still think that there's a way to address that if you're the Soto group by continuing to play up the option of renovating Key Arena into a concert-only facility, and then the amount of tax revenues that are currently, you know, being redirected into the Key Arena proposal by the Oakview group. You know, I think there's a chance. I just don't think this is an issue that necessarily the mayoral candidates have studied that closely at this point.
Yes.
So there are other votes here that
So what else happened in the other votes? Port Commissioner being an important one?
Yeah, well, let's start with Seattle City. So
okay.
Where the incumbent who was up for re-election, Lorena Gonzalez, who had only served part of her term, overwhelmingly crushing the opposition for position number 9, one of the two at-large positions. She's got 61% of the early vote.
Okay.
20% for Pat Murakami. Looks like will be the other person on the ballot in November. The other position that is open and up for grabs because of Tim Purgis retiring is much more closely contested. It looks at this point like Teresa Mosqueda is going to be the favorite for this. She's got 31% of the vote. I really do not know anything about where she stands.
Was Burgess a yes on the street vacation prior, Lena?
Yes, all the male members of the city council. Prior. So, yeah, it does create a bit of uncertainty around that. But again, this new council doesn't take power until January.
Okay.
Could be long after that's decided. So, you mentioned the port, which is interesting because of their historic opposition to the Soto Arena plan.
And there were two candidates who ran as pro-Soto Arena, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of a desperate move on their part.
Yeah.
And they did not, as far as I can tell, advance. But it's interesting. So, the position one, which is the leader of the Seattle Port of Seattle Commission, commissioner position one, John Creighton, who has been the leading voice, you know, the voice of the Port of Seattle, not an overwhelming lead so far. He's got 35% of the vote to 28% for Ryan Calkins, and they've split it a little bit. One of the other pro-Soto arena candidates was in that race. So interesting to see. I mean, there's been some issues in terms of financial mismanagement with the port. Could end up costing John Creighton. Huh. The other incumbent candidate, Stephanie Bowman.
And are these primaries for them? What does this mean for them? Okay.
Same thing. Stephanie Bowman, the other incumbent, leading 55% to 27%. And then there was a position that's open. And so far, former Seattle City Council member Peter Steinbrook leading that one with 25% of the vote.
Oh, nice.
So That's what we know so far. I'm sure we'll learn a lot more in the coming days and weeks as, you know, the mayoral race really takes shape between whoever is going to be challenging Jenny Durkin. But I would say not a great night for the pro-Soto contingent.
What about any other general news about the Sonics?
Well, interesting note from King 5 that David Bonderman, who is one of the investors, is part of the NHL ownership group that would be part of the Oakview proposal at Key Arena, was at Seattle City Hall this week and was spotted talking to a pair of
talking down
council.
Women at City Hall.
No.
He was the person from Uber, right?
He is the person from Uber. Okay. And it was interesting. So this came out when he was first introduced as part of the group, but I had forgotten it. I'm reading right now Beta Ball by Eric Malinowski, his book that talks about the Warriors' growth into a dynasty in the NBA. I have a review copy of that. And he mentions in there. Yeah.
That's a Beta Ball name dropping.
It was. He mentions in there that Bonderman was one of the bidders on the Warriors when they were sold to the group led by Joe Lacob and Peter Guber.
Interesting. So why is he just hockey then?
I don't know that he necessarily would be strictly hockey. I mean, so like Joe Lacob, intriguingly enough, he is a minority investor in the Boston Celtics right now and would have to give up that share to be part of an NBA ownership group. But I think it's certainly possible that he could be interested in bringing the NBA to Seattle as well.
I mean, honestly, Bonderman solves a lot of our problems here, right?
In terms of
the most important thing to me is that an owner is going to want a stake in the arena.
Right. So, yes, him already being involved with the ownership, the arena ownership group. Yeah, that is a positive. And, you know, certainly with a net wealth of, I believe, $2.4 billion, he's got enough money to be involved in both the NHL and NBA ownership groups as well as the arena as a whole.
So he's rich.
Not quite as rich as Jeff Bezos, temporarily the richest man.
Is he still the richest man in the world?
Nah, it like came and went in the same day.
We had a long conversation at work about whether Jeff Bezos cared about being the richest man in the world, and we determined that he really cared about it.
So also on the arena front, the next meeting of the Seattle City Council's Special Committee on Arenas will be next Monday at 10:30 a.m. We'll probably learn a little something there.
Are you going to go to that?
Maybe.
Is it open to the public?
Yeah, it is. These aren't really particularly eventful at this point, but I will consider that. Then also, David Aldridge had a piece on NBA.com this week in the wake of Adam Silver's expansion comments last week, basically throwing a lot of cold water on that, talking to various owners who remained anonymous, most of whom were skeptical about the prospects for expansion, and really hammered the idea of needing to make sure that, you know, the 30 current teams are in markets where they're able to make money before thinking about expansion, which we'll see whether that translates into some more movement in terms of teams being relocated.
Really?
We'll see. Stay tuned on that one.
Okay.
All right. Should we talk about the Seahawks?
Absolutely. It's been a long time.
We talked about them a little bit last week,
but
now
really
we've got
getting into
a
it. Football. Football
news.
Is back.
It is. Training camp opened on Sunday, and it took approximately 45 minutes for Seahawks Twitter to work itself into a full-on mid-season panic.
It was a great day.
Was it, though?
It was a great day for panicking online.
So CJ Procise was absent from that first practice. We later learned he was just, Pete Carroll said at Tuesday's practice that after Procise did return to practice, that he just ate something bad and was out a couple of days because of that.
And there,
CJ Procise is fine.
He probably went to Chipotle.
You can make that joke, I guess, as a Chipotle fan. Everyone remained calm there. Obviously, the other issue was the unexplained absence of Malik McDowell and various cryptic tweets online of dubious veracity, uncertain veracity, suggesting that this could be a serious issue. And we found out later when the Seahawks released a statement that it was because of, well, they termed it a vehicle accident. We subsequently found out it was an ATV accident.
Which is a vehicle.
It is. Where McDowell suffered a concussion and facial injuries, believed to be an issue with his orbital bones. So he reported to the team on Tuesday.
He's in Seattle now.
He is now in Seattle after originally not reporting. I would say a lot of the panic seemed to be about Pete Carroll when asked, you know, is there a possibility he misses the entire season, saying, I don't know, we'll see. Which I think people read as, oh my God, he might miss the entire season, as opposed to Pete Carroll was probably intended as, we don't know.
Yes. Sometimes people read too much into the Pete Carroll tea leaves.
Sometimes? Are there times they don't?
Okay, so first off, do you think the Seahawks knew about this before Sunday? Because if they did, it was handled very poorly. Right? The chances that people wouldn't notice that their first draft pick wasn't at practice are very slim.
That was a nice use of first draft pick instead of first round pick, since he wasn't technically. Yeah, I think that the uncertainty around it, the fact that they didn't announce it ahead of time, to me, it's all consistent with them not finding out until.
Do you think they didn't read those tweets where he's like, I'm just happy to be alive? And they're like, oh, Malik's just stoked to be alive.
I mean, again, we talked about people reading too much into things.
I mean, now it seems so apparent, right? After knowing what happened, you look back at that tweet and you're like, oh, okay. But
the timing still doesn't make sense with when they said he was injured, which was, I think, a couple weeks ago. And that tweet was like, early. I guess it was a couple weeks
ago. Yeah, it makes exact sense.
All right. I rescind that comment. Strike that from the record.
I mean, there's no question to me that what the tweet is about from Malik McDowell.
But it's their response, especially knowing what we know about orbital injuries, which is that, you know, unless they are caused by players being poked in the eye, which has a tendency to affect their vision, they aren't necessarily something that causes players to miss that much time. You know, if there's surgery, it could be, you know, a month or two. That's kind of the historical precedent. I'm actually reading much more into the NBA precedent, which is what I'm more familiar with, orbital injuries. But when you don't need surgery, guys can play within like a week or so. Like, it's not a season ending or like even career threatening got thrown around when people were really going crazy.
I don't know if anybody said that. I saw Malik McDowell respond to that, but I don't know. I didn't see anybody say
it. No one actually said that?
I mean, I'm sure somebody said it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you respond to a perceived idea that's not even really out there. But anyway, all of that seems to be consistent to me with the Seahawks not knowing and just having a lot of uncertainty about the situation beforehand. And the other aspect that goes into here is because of the fact that ATV riding, I never actually double checked this, but I'm sure it's prohibited by the NFL contract. Like, it's impossible to me that it's not prohibited by the NFL contract. You know, he could be subject to discipline, or even, you know, had he been severely injured such that it was season or career threatening, you know, could have lost his contract or his salary.
If the Seahawks also wanted to pursue that.
Right.
Where it seemed like the precedent for that actually happening is not great.
A limited precedent?
Well, and from the team's perspective, the precedent is not solid. They're going to have to honor the contract. But
I mean, if it was a more serious injury, I don't think they necessarily would.
Like Jay Williams. Plaxico Burress, they had to honor the contract, and he shot himself. But I don't know if that's prohibited under the NFL contract.
It may not specifically. I mean, spelunking probably is, but I don't know about that.
Spelunking probably is. But can we
agree? No, because spelunking is in baseball contracts, and I remember, like, very vividly as a child.
Like Alex Rios was spelunking or something?
And having no idea what spelunking was.
David Nielsen was spelunking one day. Anyway, can we agree that before you go to your first NFL training camp, you shouldn't violate the NFL contract?
I think we can agree on that, yes. It's a bad idea. I don't know that riding an ATV is ever that great of an idea. I was doing it over the weekend.
Yeah, I was not in favor.
And I was asking if we wanted to ride, and the answer was unquestionably no. No, I'm good.
I went out of my way to say no to that.
Also, seeing what happened to The Rock in that monster truck this weekend.
Oh, so I mean, the Ballers on HBO precedent for this is really impressive.
I mean, you tweeted, does Ballers imitate life or life imitate Ballers? I mean, the answer is both, because obviously Ballers was going off real incidents where players have been injured and off, you know.
But field. It's like, you just don't go paintball, right? Because did Vernon miss an entire season because of that?
I think in the show he was able to return midseason.
He missed a significant amount of time.
But we know the NBA players. Also, is Tim Duncan, like, noted paintballer.
Oh, really? Is Larry Zonka the coach of the Dolphins in the show?
I believe he's, like, the offensive coordinator or
no,
something.
No, the offensive coordinator got fired.
Oh, right. I don't know. I think he's, like, a position coach, though. Or is he the coach? No, yeah, he's not the coach, I don't think.
Okay, anyway, we'll be back to Ballers on HBO soon, but not today. But it's just such a devastating injury, because we know everybody who is out there, right? We know that Malik McDowell would have been great to have on the team. I'm running under the assumption right now.
Would have been great to have on the team? I mean,
that's what I'm saying, is I'm running under the assumption that he's going to miss the entire season.
I am not running under the assumption. I would not be surprised to see him on play in the opening game.
Wow! You don't know anything about pessimism.
I'm not necessarily counting on that. Like, the other thing is,
Jermaine Defetti was in camp last year on the first day, and he didn't even play in the first game.
Well, yeah, he suffered a subsequent injury. I mean, obviously, this sets him behind. It's bad from that standpoint, although I think defensive line is not a position where the practice reps are as important as other positions.
But so the issue was, we knew that there were so many different players who were out there, right? And there were some who I think we would have preferred to have. Where you talk about defensive line, I think it's an important issue, and I want to talk about that when we talk
about
the
subtweeting Kevin King.
I'm not subtweeting Kevin King. I'm saying...
I'm sorry, stop subtweeting John Schneider about Kevin King.
Kevin King could be, there would be a good chance that he would be a starter on day one for the Seahawks.
You think so? Given, I mean, maybe in...
Yes.
Given how well Jeremy Lane is playing, I mean, if you consider the slot, you know, a starter, which is probably fair.
I am considering that. And look, there's a good chance that Malik McDowell is a starter on day one too, right? If he's healthy. But he's somebody who they drafted who had character concerns. And unfortunately, they've done it in the past. Frank Clark did too, and no issues whatsoever as far as we know, right?
So far, so good.
So, you know, I was wondering about that. How many times have the Seahawks drafted or signed players who had quote-unquote character concerns? And I think they've been pretty successful all of those times.
Yeah, I mean, Percy, are we counting Percy Harvin in this category?
I don't know if anybody was really... I think people were more concerned with his injury concerns.
I think there were some concerns about his fit off the field. Those proved well-founded.
But because they were so... It was a group of four or five players who they could have drafted, and now you're looking at maybe Malik McDowell's back on week one, maybe he misses the entire season. We don't know. So it's looking like it's going to be... There's a good chance it's a very disappointing first pick, at least for this season, which to me also the bigger issue is for next season, right? Let's say that he does miss the entire year. He's still a rookie. You look at Frank Clark, didn't have that great of a rookie season, but progressed every year, right? Next year, we'd be looking at a Malik McDowell who could be a beast of an interior pass rusher. And now, all of a sudden, that's 2 years down the road. All of a sudden, the rest of the defense is that much older.
I think you're jumping way ahead in terms of your assumptions.
Because of him missing the season? I'm surprised.
Because of this idea.
I'm surprised
history is not consistent with a season-ending injury.
We have no idea how severe this injury is.
We don't. But I'm saying, in terms of
let's say that's
a reasonable expectation.
Let's say that he was generally fine.
If Thomas Rawls sprains his ankle in practice tomorrow, I'm not going to be like, oh, his career's over, like, because I understand what happens with sprained ankles. Like, obviously, there's uncertainty, and every player is different.
Why did he show up on the first day of camp, then? Let's say that he's probably fine.
Probably because he did something he wasn't allowed to do based on the player contract.
He was hoping that he could just stay home and nobody would notice?
I mean, I don't think it has...
At some point, he was going to have to play football.
I think at some point soon he will play football.
Wow. I mean, I guess I admire your positivity.
I don't know what to tell you. I consider it rationalism.
Positivity's never worked out for me being a football fan before, but, you know, it's worth a shot.
Home of the Super Bowl 48 champions. Yeah, we'll see. It won the Super Bowl 43-8. If you're wearing that.
Still pessimistic.
After you predicted that they would win the Super Bowl.
43-8.
All right, should we talk about some other news from the first few days of training camp?
Yeah.
A flurry of roster moves.
Oh, yeah. I've kind of forgotten about all these.
Yeah. They brought back Marcel Reese. If I still had some beer left, I would toast to bringing back
Husky.
I'm
going to go get that Seafair beer because he's, you know.
Yeah, it's time. Sadly, that meant waving goodbye to Algernon Brown, the undrafted rookie fullback. And hopefully, you've already sent your condolences. Hopefully, you've sent flowers for Algernon.
Yes. Okay.
One last time I had to get that in.
Have you tweeted this already?
No.
That's really on brand for you.
They also make a return to the Seahawks. Mike Morgan. How about that?
Yeah, if you just
waited him out.
Stick around long enough, eventually the Seahawks will sign you again.
And the Seahawks, to make room for him, is part of that competition at strong side linebacker where he started last season. waived Arthur Brown, who they'd signed from Baltimore over the offseason. I think one reason Arthur Brown might have been expendable, he was looked at as more as a special teams contributor than an every down linebacker, and they picked up a valuable special teams contributor in a trade last week with the Kansas City Chiefs, sending Kevin Pierre-Louis, and we'll pour some out for his spark score. It was so good. Never really translated into performance at linebacker. He did become a pretty useful special teams player, but not as good as Alexander, a Pro Bowler in Kansas City under noted Chiefs special teams coach Dave Tube, who has historically had some of the league's best special teams. But the Chiefs, I think, seeing more of a chance for Pierre-Louis to actually contribute for them is a linebacker, moving to inside linebacker in their 3-4 system.
When he's somebody, Kevin Pierre-Louis's contract is up this year, right? And Alexander is signed through next year.
Yeah, at a very low price. So a lot to like
about
from the Seahawks standpoint. Seahawks also signed defensive tackle Rodney Coe, about whom I know nothing, and Marcus Smith, a former high draft pick by the Philadelphia Eagles.
Very intriguing one.
Yeah, who is coming in to compete at strong side linebacker and then also maybe play with his hand on the ground as a rush end in some passing situations.
Which is generally where it looked like he played most for Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, he was never very effective at generating a pass rush in Philadelphia, which is why he was a bit of a disappointment there. But also excited because of the fact that Shil Kapadia, the ESPN Seahawks writer, gets to continue being the world's foremost Marcus Smith expert after covering him in Philadelphia.
But I like that signing. I mean, Deion Jordan was somebody who we talked about previously, who was another high draft pick.
Do you want my hot take?
What?
Deion Jordan never wears a Seahawks jersey.
I think that's looking more and more likely. But you just like bringing guys in.
Yeah.
And having Marcus Smith around, not bad at all.
Yeah, it's part of the competition. The other bit of news, which we have not discussed, Cam Chancellor. A toast to him signing an extension. 3 years, $36 million, $25 million guaranteed, according to his agent. This compares to the contract that we noted, I think everybody noted earlier in the offseason, signed by Rashad Jones of the Dolphins, who was drafted the same year, plays the same position, and has made virtually the same amount of money throughout his career as Cam Chancellor. So his contract is actually 7 years.
I should have looked up on the Football Outsiders Almanac how he rates statistically versus Cam Chancellor.
Probably not as well, is my guess. But, you know, it's always hard to kind of really compare NFL contracts because of the many, you know, non-guaranteed seasons and things like that. But, you know, if the Dolphins were to move on from Rashad Jones after 3 years at the same point as the Seahawks will be able to get out of this Cam Chancellor contract because it will end, they would pay him $35 million after those 3 years. So I think very similar in those regards. Cam a little more in terms of guaranteed money at the date of signing, but, you know, not the kind of long-term big salaries that Rashad Jones got in this contract. So I like it.
I like it, too. I mean, it's not crazy money. The other thing is, I want to talk about this in 1 second.
I mean, it is still a lot of money for a safety.
For a safety.
It's the most, I think it might be the most guaranteed money that a safety has gotten at the time of signing, even ahead of Eric Berry, who got a much more lucrative contract in terms of total money. But, I mean, I think it shows that the Seahawks, you think back to the Cam Chancellor holdout 2 years ago, the Seahawks were very clear, like, look, we're not doing anything right now. You get to the final year of your contract, we'll talk about it. They continue to take care of guys in the final year of their contract, Michael Bennett last year being another example.
Yes. And they've definitely committed to kind of the keeping the band together approach. I'll be curious to look at as some historical references to that. I want to look at, as time goes on, I want to look at the Steelers with their defense as of a couple of years ago, the Ravens with their solid defense as it aged, how that went for them keeping those guys together. But right now, I still feel like most of the players are in their prime. But also this week, well, I guess first I want to talk about the offensive line, because I felt like we got a little bit of news offensive line-wise, and have a general sense of what looks to be kind of the projected starting offensive line.
I think you're reading too much into this. We saw a report, so you're noting that the offensive line early in camp, the first team, was
Fant, Jokel, Britt, Glowinski, Ifedi.
Which is what I predicted many months ago when you predicted.
If that's the opening day.
You predicted line. Bradley Soule and Gary Gilliam starting at all five positions somehow, if I recall correctly. Yeah. But, I mean, there was a report today that the first team line at the end of practice was Jokel at right tackle. I think it was Odhiambo at left tackle. Like, a completely different combination. Like, look, they're going to look at a number of different combinations in camp. I feel less sad about this than you do. But I do think Fant is pretty heavy favorite right now to start at left tackle.
And it seems like John and Pete have gone another way to really praise George Fant, too.
And if you have him at left tackle, it's sort of the rest of the line falls into place from there in all likelihood.
Yes.
My other hot take.
Oh.
I know you're an Ode Ibushi fan.
Love Ode Ibushi.
I think he's going to get cut.
What?
Because I don't think the Seahawks like guys that can play strictly at one position, and we haven't seen him, as far as I've seen in any of the reports, playing anywhere but right guard. It's the Jari Evans situation all over again.
Which was a really bad decision.
It was, but the Seahawks want...
You think they've learned nothing. Your hot take is the Seahawks have not learned from any mistakes.
I mean, it was a bad decision in some regards.
Their approach to the offensive line has been different this summer than it has been almost any other year.
But if you're not going to start that guy, he has to be able to play multiple positions. You just don't have enough guys up on game day to get away with single position backups.
I think Ode Ibushi can play multiple positions.
All right, well, we'll see. That's my hot take.
Terrible take.
Look, you predicted every single veteran the Seahawks ever signed for
this
agency is going to get cut.
This one is wrong. I'm trying to think if there's anybody who I think will get cut this year.
Well, many players will get cut.
Any veteran free agents that they've signed who I think will get cut. I mean, Deion Jordan's an obvious one. But anybody who expect to contribute.
McDougal is really the only one besides the offensive line, isn't he?
Blair Walsh. I could predict Blair Walsh will get cut.
Yeah, there's no other kickers on the roster. Also, can I say something to people?
Oh, I can't wait.
Don't pay any attention to field goal stats.
I love training kit. I thought your thing that you were going to say was chill the fuck out.
I didn't need to get there necessarily. People are more calm right
that's
now.
I'm saying that on behalf of Bob Condotta.
Here's the thing. Entire season field goal stats don't carry over from year to year because of the fact that the sample is too small. So the four kicks Blair Walsh had the first day, that's probably not telling us that much. Let's just everyone remain calm.
Okay. So also this week, an important event happened, which was the release of the Football Outsiders 2017 Almanac.
Always a favorite. I look forward to having you order the print version for me off Prime.
Wait, I have to do that for you?
Yeah, you need to get on that.
Okay. You told me you were going to order it yesterday.
Yeah, then I remembered you had Prime.
You meant realized that you were going to ask me to order it yesterday. So some quick stats about the season from Football Outsiders projection. Their projection is 9.8 wins, which I believe is second most of any team.
I think that is correct. It's a little down from last season when they projected the Seahawks to win 10.5 games. Very rarely is 10.5 projection dead on. In that case, it was. By the way, you saw the NFL Network graphic where they were projecting off last season.
No, it was
schedule.
Actually an old thing that they aired.
Disappointing.
They weren't doing the right thing. They just aired something from a year ago.
I don't want this context.
But given the odds of making the postseason at 64%, of winning the Super Bowl at 17.3%, which is pretty amazing. Look, if we could play out this season 1,000 times and the Seahawks would win the Super Bowl 17.3% of those times, I'd be very in on that.
Look, I mean, the Seahawks are very much in the mix. They're still in the mix.
And then basically from winning 8 to 11-plus games, an 82% chance.
Okay.
There's basically no chance statistically for this team to have severe regression.
I mean, 18% is not no chance, or I guess some of that is 12-plus wins.
No, 5 to 7 would be 15, and 0 to 4 would be 2%.
I'd be really surprised if the Seahawks won 0 to 4 games.
I mean, Russell would have to get hurt.
Don't even speak that.
Giants, knock on wood. but so I want to look at a couple of takeaways that there were, because there are stats in here that we don't have access to from Football Outsiders throughout the year.
Yeah, maybe, some of the splits.
Maybe if you have their advanced charting systems, but specifically to me were the defensive stats, which I thought were interesting. I guess first off, the main takeaway is, dear God, Earl Thomas better be healthy.
And practicing fully so far. So again, great to hear. Yeah, I mean, we had seen those DVOA splits previously.
Yes. So a couple of things that I took from this was, you look at the defensive line and especially the interior defensive line. And this is something that I talked about briefly before, where it felt like we weren't getting a lot of pressure from those positions. And now there's some stats to back that up. So you look across the board and in total, 16 total hurries from Ataba Rubin, Tony Daniel, and Jaron Reed. Where it feels it's like 5-5-6 for those players.
Which is not what those guys do.
Sure.
But if the Seahawks also
like
had
what? Getting hurries from 5 hurries throughout the season feels like they should accidentally get that.
Yeah. I mean, they were what, 12th in run defense DVOA all time?
Yes.
Which shows you, by the way, how important run defense DVOA is.
And the defense was still pretty good. But
not after Earl Thomas was injured. The run defense stayed fine after Earl Thomas was injured, and the defense overall was not good, because it turns out teams pass more than they run, and passing is more effective than running.
But this is the place where Malik McDowell is a difference maker.
Yeah, we're in agreement here.
And if he were playing, let's say he plays a full season, let's say your optimism pays off for whatever reason, he's going to be at double-digit hurries next year.
Oh, yeah, I would expect that for sure.
But a lot of that is, look, they're expecting those players to stop the run, and they're expecting a lot of the pass rush to come from Cliff Averill, Frank Clark, and Michael Bennett.
Yeah.
Which will continue to
do. And especially because those guys aren't playing on passing downs.
Yes. All three of them were excellent last year.
Yeah.
It was kind of interesting to see. I was looking at that hurry stat. Also, Frank Clark, who played basically the entire season with 22 hurries. Michael Bennett, who only played in 11 games with 27.
Oh, Michael Bennett's awesome.
Oh, my God.
He's really good.
I mean, there are a lot of things where I kind of balk at the idea that players are declining. It's like people say players are declining, but
I don't think anyone said Michael Bennett was declining.
I mean, there's talk of him potentially declining.
Yeah, I mean, given his age, he has the potential to decline. That's accurate.
Any assumption about players declining feels to me like Earl Thomas just happened to have gotten injured.
That's probably a lot of it.
But the other thing is just how good KJ Wright was last year. We kind of talked about this through the year.
Yeah, we did.
But somebody were cheersing KJ Wright.
Yeah.
But KJ Wright, who made his first Pro Bowl last year, who's somebody who was in the top 10 overall against the pass, not as good against the run, but somebody who was involved in a ton of plays for the Seahawks. Not as many as Bobby Wagner, who was involved in the second most plays of anybody in the NFL defensively. It was kind of everywhere.
Hurries for Bobby Wagner? Because he's such a good blitzer.
He had 14 hurries.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice. For a middle linebacker, that's amazing.
But then also, okay, in the secondary, this is where bringing up Kevin King matters. These two places, look, in the draft, you have to allocate certain resources to certain places, right? You don't get endless second-round picks.
Oh, man.
No matter how much Pete Carroll and John Schneider would love second-round picks.
They really want more like endless fifth-round picks, I feel like.
But the thing that I thought was really interesting to see was how much the ball is thrown toward Deshaun Shedd. And you look at how many plays he was involved in, it was the second most of anybody in the league percentage-wise.
Yeah.
And it's Richard Sherman is shutting down the other side of the field. People aren't throwing toward him that much. Although statistically, I wouldn't say that he shut it down, I guess. But,
well,
people aren't throwing toward Richard Sherman's side of the field as much as they're throwing to Deshaun Shedd's side. They're throwing a lot to Deshaun Shedd's side.
I mean, Aaron Rodgers has thrown, like, what, two passes at Richard Sherman in, like, the last 5 years or something?
He's got a complex.
I'm exaggerating here, but it's
still not that many more.
I'm not that much, yeah.
But that's why this the opposite cornerback position is so important. And having Shedd be injured to begin the season, I'm very fascinated to see who they go with at that position.
I mean, all the reports from training camp sound very positive about Jeremy Lane's performance so far. And I think he's due for a regression to the mean this season.
I mean, I think Jeremy Lane will be totally fine. But also, when we look at it, where is it?
But obviously, you need someone else.
They're playing 68% of the time with five defensive backs on the field. Yeah. So it's not just Jeremy. Look, if for the 31% of the time that they have four defensive backs on the field, that's fine. But it's an overwhelming number, more than double that they're playing in the nickel.
It sounds like Nico Thorpe so far has been the player who's kind of gotten the first look in that right corner slot.
When he has the most experience.
Yeah.
But are we trusting that many passes being thrown at Nico Thorpe?
We'll see.
Okay, so the last thing was, we're talking about Cam Chancellor. And this is the other thing that I've balked at. A lot of people have said that Cam Chancellor is declining. And you look at him overall, Cam Chancellor ranking fifth in plays defensed overall, third against the run, fifth against the pass overall.
Among safeties. Yeah, that's outstanding. He had a great season.
Cam Chancellor had a great season.
Yeah,
I just don't even understand, and totally earned this contract.
He's well worth the money.
So I think people are putting maybe an undue amount of negative credit to Cam Chancellor because of Earl Thomas's injury. When look, Cam Chancellor he's not used to defending that part of the field. That's not his responsibility.
No, it's not what he should be doing. It's not what he will be doing.
So.
Yeah. All right. So some other notes, maybe. Speaking of Deshaun Shedd, Pete Carroll said that he underwent a minor knee procedure that is designed to aid his recovery from last year's torn ACL. He is on the PUP list, of course, to start training camp along with Tyler Lockett, who it sounds like will be off fairly soon as he comes back from his broken leg at the end of last year. And then Justin Senior dealing with a knee injury. Not good for his chances of making the team, certainly, is a late-round offensive line pick. And then Deion Jordan, as we mentioned, on the non-football injury list.
And then what about Earl Thomas's health?
Seems to be full go at this point, so that's very exciting. It seems like the sense is that Rawls is kind of getting the first carries at running back so far. I mean, as we talked about last week, it's not really like there's going to be a dramatic difference between the starter and the backup at that position, but so far so good for Rawls. And Russell Wilson praising draft pick Amara Darboh for his ability to contribute right away at wide receiver.
Nice. It's a very crowded wide receiver. Which is
always translated into excellent careers for any young draft pick that Russell Wilson has praised early in their career. And then, of course, the most important news from the first week of training camp, that Kendrick Lamar was at Saints training camp. Hey.
I was thinking of that. So he came because he's friends with Bobby Wagner, right?
Yes.
How cool was Bobby Wagner at that training camp?
Pretty cool. Also, I like Seahawks players making fun of Kendrick Lamar for how short he is. It was Eddie Lacy who said he didn't realize he was that short, right?
I think basically everybody said they didn't realize he was that short.
Like, did they not watch the video? Like,
seem that short?
I think it's a well-known fact that Kendrick Lamar... I definitely knew that Kendrick Lamar was short. I'm pretty sure this has come up on a Friday Mailbag podcast.
As a fellow short person...
You're like 1 inch shorter than me. I love it.
He's shorter than me.
Is he?
I think so. Maybe the same height.
There you go.
As a fellow short person, seeing how short Kendrick Lamar was made me feel good about the possibilities of me being the best rapper alive.
I don't think there's any indication that height is a prevents people from doing that, but okay, good to know. Good to know. Anything else on the Seahawks, or should we get into the roundup?
Let's get into the roundup.
I think that means it's time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Can you feel it?
What?
That feeling is it happening.
Wow, I did not expect this take. It's like every other week.
Right now, the Mariners sit a game and a half out of the wild card, coming off a four-game win streak, tied with the Kansas City Royals in the win column. And I'm telling you right now, they have a four-game set with the Royals this weekend. It is the most important series of the season.
Okay.
Not as of now, the most important series of the season, bar none. I'm assuming excluding nobody.
I'm assuming this is in Kansas City.
In Kansas City.
The Royals have played really good baseball since their slow start, correct?
Until now.
Oh.
When we talk next week, we will be talking about the in the playoffs, if the playoffs started today, Seattle Mariners.
That is really cumbersome. Much more difficult than the Super Bowl 48 champions.
That's how we're going to introduce the podcast.
Well, we're not recording in Seattle, so we can't introduce
like the Mariners making the playoffs would be more impressive. The Seahawks have been in the Super Bowl 3 times since the Mariners have made the playoffs.
God, that's true, isn't it? Wow.
Making the playoffs would be more impressive even as the wild card.
The Sonics have made the playoffs twice since the Mariners made the playoffs.
Oh, man. Anyway, it is all happening, and they get to the playoffs. You have one game. Cy Young winner James Paxton is on the mound. He's back, baby!
He is. How do you feel about this? What's the name of the section for him?
I have no idea.
They've got like a maple or something.
Something Canadian.
And they hold A signs instead of K.
I think I'm in on it. I'm in on everything. I'm in on all of it. And you know what the turning point was. We were there last week recording a four-man podcast.
Sure,
people were mocking me for not knowing that Troy Maine Pope had signed with the Colts.
That's accurate.
And later that night, the Mariners at like 12:30 a.m. winning on a walk-off. That was the turning point.
Okay.
They go and they win a series against the Red Sox. They win a series against the Mets. They've taken two in a row against the Rangers, and that will propel them. This is more important than the 95 Mariners. This is bigger than that.
Okay. Let's not say things we might regret. How do you feel about this?
They're getting that stadium built.
Yeah. How do you feel? They're not going to move to I don't know. Where were they going to move?
Tampa? No.
Tampa, I think it was. How do you feel about the Steve Cishek for Erasmo Ramirez trade in the return of Erasmo Ramirez?
Erasmo is back, baby. I'm actually kind of down on it.
Okay.
Kind of like Steve Cishek. I think it's because I had him in fantasy a couple years ago.
How do you feel about Sonny Gray going to the Yankees?
Oh, we didn't want him.
That's great. That's great stuff. Anything else on the Mariners?
I can't wait. Okay. Here's the last hot take. This series this weekend is so important that I plan on watching at least one of these games.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is a bold statement.
Yeah. Out of those four games, I will watch at least an inning.
Okay. Good for you. On to the Sounders, who had a thrilling 0-0 draw Saturday against the LA Galaxy. No, it was not thrilling. I was watching it on my phone, but the Sounders did have the better of chances, I think, in this game. A decent performance.
We still have a ton of hydroplane stuff to talk about.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be such a long pod. Decent performance for them on the road. Did have, come out fair better by expected goals. This Wednesday will be the MLS All-Star Game.
Oh.
Only Stephen Fry will be there from the Sounders.
Is he going to play?
I don't know.
Is he the starting goalie?
No, I don't think so. Great. I don't know how many keepers play. I haven't watched the MLS All-Star Game in a while.
Keepers. Who are they're playing? Man U? Man City?
Not even sure.
Yeah, they're honestly playing Man City.
Okay. There you go. On Saturday, the Sounders will begin, you can't really call it the second half. Even in the MLS season, as long as it is, we are still past the halfway mark.
Wow.
But they will face Minnesota United, who has kind of been a typical expansion team in a league that is not the MLS. They are 10th out of 11 teams in the Western Conference on 22 points. They have the second lowest rating in the Soccer Power Index on 538. They're last in expected goal differential. And they're allowing 0.2 more goals per expected goals per 90 minutes than anyone else in MLS. But, and there's a but, they've actually been really good at home. Or decent, at least. They're 6-5
and by Man U, I mean Real Madrid.
Okay, there you go. They're 6-5-2 at home. On the road, they are 0-7-2. They have not won a road game yet in their existence as a franchise. But the Sounders will have to find a way to get a result in Minnesota. They are favored in this one by Soccer Power Index. So I think a pretty good chance of getting at least a point and a decent chance of 3 points. So some roster news.
Where do the Sounders sit as of right now?
They are still, I think they're, I can't remember if they dropped to fifth, but fourth or fifth in the West.
Should I join the MLS in Chicago for the headline clash with Real Madrid? AX Ambassadors concert? Men and Blazers, the homegrown
game?
Yeah,
we already missed out on the Men and Blazers concert. That would be the highlight of the week. Or the show. Sounders tied for fourth with Portland. Portland's still with that extra, Sounders still with a game in hand over Portland, but only 1 point ahead of Vancouver, who has two games in hand left on the Sounders.
Okay.
So fifth right now in points per game in the Western Conference. Looking good to make the playoffs, still with a chance to move up as solidly as they're playing. And again, some more roster changes coming in from the Sounders. Some sad news. Pour some out for Jovan Jones.
Don't literally.
Yeah. Who has signed a pre-contract with second Bundesliga side Darmstadt.
Darmstadt!
And was pointed out by Sounders GM Garth Lagerwey. This is one of the reasons the Sounders were able to trade for Jovan Jones from the Chicago Fire before the 2016 season was the fact that he only had 2 years left on his contract with the MLS. So despite, you know, the Sounders trying to keep him coming as part of this outstanding season where he is second in the league in assists, he decided to go play in Europe and take his skills over there, which is, you know, exciting, but very disappointing.
Sounders
to see
just can't keep young, aggressive left or right backs.
No. But the good news is Nuhu has played so well at left back that it takes some of the sting out of this. Although I was surprised Garth Lagerwey didn't really commit to Nuhu as the long-term starter there.
I mean, it's early. He's very young.
He's very young and very inconsistent, but he's also been a huge spark in this strong play of late. But the incoming move here, not necessarily corresponding, the Sounders expecting to sign attacking midfielder Victor Rodriguez using targeted allocation money. He's been at training this week, expected to sign in time for that game on Saturday. He's a product of Barcelona's youth academy, who played for Gijon in the La Liga last year. Before that, that side was relegated, and that's what opened him up for the free transfer to come to the MLS. So the Sounders will still have the opportunity to open up a designated player slot to add someone else potentially. We'll see if they make any more moves by the end of the transfer window.
Just quickly on Jovan Jones.
Yeah.
Is playing in the second league, the second Bundesliga or whatever they call it,
second division,
more prestigious, or does that prepare you more for playing at a bigger stage than playing in the MLS?
I think generally, yes. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily, you know, you're definitely not playing in front of bigger crowds than you would with the Sounders, but, you know, the money is probably somewhat similar, I would say.
And you think the competition is better there?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it probably is.
All right.
Yeah.
I mean, I never heard of Darmstadt 98 when he signed with them. But I was hoping at the very least that it was a deep Bundesliga team.
A team that you'd have a chance to, like, follow him,
basically.
Yeah, so that's disappointing. Also coming in MLS this weekend, video review.
Really?
The MLS will become the third league in the world
mid-season
to adopt video.
When the season never ends, you can just add things mid-season.
Yeah, they couldn't wait for the end of the season because there is no such thing. We should also talk about last weekend and a toast.
There were various toasting and pouring things out today.
A lot of toasting. A toast to Jordan Morris for scoring the winning goal for the U.S. MNT in last week's Gold Cup final as they defeated the Reggae Boys from Jamaica 2-1 in that final in San Francisco and Santa Clara at Levi's Stadium.
So, and also Clint Dempsey having a header that could have easily gone in.
Yeah, Sounders very involved with that. There was a cool photo that Sounders FC tweeted of Morris and Dempsey and then Christian Roldan, who
just asking why the attack is so bad considering all these players are playing on the national
level.
Well,
Roldan was back, obviously, for the game. I mean, all these guys were back. Morris didn't get
Not
the
in
start.
That game, but in general the entire season.
Yeah. But Roldan got the opportunity to go down and join the USMNT for the final, despite having been sent back to the Sounders midway through this tournament. So that was cool to see. Also, the U.S. women's national team lost in Seattle last week to Australia in the opener of the Tournament of Nations. Then on Sunday in San Diego, rallied to beat Brazil 4-3 behind a goal and two assists from Megan Rapinoe.
There we go.
They were down.
Tournament of Nations win would be huge.
Yeah, they were down 3-1 and scored three goals in, I believe, like the last 20 minutes to come back and win that game against Brazil. So not a real strong Tournament of Nations so far for the U.S. WNT. They closed that tournament Thursday against Japan, and NWSL play resumes on Saturday with the Sounders visiting North Carolina. Or the Sounders, the Rain, visiting North Carolina.
Okay.
In Seattle Storm action, a 109-93 win on Friday against Dallas, the highest shooting percentage in franchise history in that game as they racked up an incredible point total in a 40-minute game. Then on Sunday, went on the road and lost 93-82 at Minnesota, the best team in the WNBA. This week, they'll continue on the road. That road trip takes them on Friday to Dallas and Saturday to San Antonio. So they'll try to stay unbeaten against the two Texas teams so far this season. A good chance for the Storm to get some road victories before they go Tuesday to Connecticut. And that road trip still continues. They have one more game at Phoenix. The second,
you've named every WNBA team now.
I'm pretty close. The third matchup this season for the Storm against Kelsey Plum with the San Antonio Stars, who got their third win of the season on Tuesday night. Kudos to them. Kelsey Plum into the starting lineup. She's played a little better lately. She had a two-game stretch around the All-Star break where she scored 31 points on 10 of 16 shooting, including 3 of 4 from three-point range, and had 9 assists against 2 turnovers in those games. Her shooting percentage has dropped lately, but the Stars finally playing her along with last year's number 2 overall pick, Mariah Jefferson, and their first-round pick from the previous season, Kayla McGride. Those are the three best perimeter players. They had inexplicably declined to play them together. I mean, not totally inexplicably. Like, defensively, that lineup has some issues, but they still kind of need to do that because they have three wins this season.
You might want to try some things out. Just taking a while to get adjusted.
Yeah. UW football also kicking off training camp this week on Monday. A few changes to the roster we found out about. A couple players, Nick Little, wide receiver and defensive back, Brandon Lewis, taking medical retirement. Quarterback Tony Rodriguez, who had provided depth at that position, decided to retire and kind of move on with his life and after spending 4 years in college. And then safety Trevor Walker, a reserve at the position, transferring to Texas Tech. But good news that nose tackle Greg Gaines and outside linebacker Connor O'Brien, both full participants so far, coming back from injuries that ended their previous seasons. And it seems like the guy who's really been turning heads for the Huskies at fall camp so far is true freshman running back Selvin Ahmed from Juanita, who is a speedy back who is also getting some looks at wide receiver.
Really?
Yeah.
So. I thought you were going to say Benning Potoai.
That's what you're reading?
Who seems like somebody who might be a breakout star this year on the defense.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised by that.
But most importantly, the news coming out today that during homecoming, the Huskies going to unveil a Don James statue at Husky Stadium.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I'm not a big fan of statues. Is that a hot take?
You're not a fan of statues?
Is that take too hot?
They're great to tear down when somebody's name has been shamed.
That's one of the reasons I'm not a big fan of that. Not that I expect that to happen with Don James. I don't think that there's any chance of that happening with Don James.
When the posthumous Don James sex scandal comes out, tear that down. It's not going to happen. Why are you not a fan of statues?
It's just not my thing.
What do the Mariners have a statue of?
Well, they have Griffey and then Niehaus, and Niehaus is in the stadium and then Griffey out front. I mean,
Ken Griffey Jr.
The Griffey statue is pretty cool. I'll give
and
you that.
Don James.
Yep, that's me.
Do you think if the Sonics Arena opens that they'll have a statue of Sean Kemp dunking on Alton Lister?
No, but if they are going to do a Sean Kemp statue, that's definitely the one to
do. Would it be the dunk or the point after?
Gotta be the point.
Okay.
That'd be the point.
That would be... Oh, man, I would love that statue. You could crouch down there and have him point at you as it was it Chris Gatling that he was pointing at?
It was Elton Lister. Chris Gatling was the one who dapped him up after Sean Kemp dunked on him, which is another amazing moment. What a series.
Cheers to Chris Gatling.
Yeah. By the way,
shouts to Chris Gatling.
Elton Lister reminded me, speaking of former Sonic centers, Kelvin Booth apparently headed to become the assistant GM of the Denver Nuggets.
Really?
Yeah, he had a nice scouting career.
Look at that.
Definitely try to say hello to him when I see him in Portland. All right. Anything else on sports, or is it time to get to the real main event?
Ugh, finally.
We've talked Seahawks, we've talked burgers, we've talked other sports. We've been waiting to talk Seafair.
That's all I've been waiting for years.
This is the most extensive unlimited hydroplane preview we'll get on any Seattle sports podcast this week. I guarantee you that. So we were at last weekend's races in the Tri-Cities, the Columbia Cup, where there were just 8 boats there, which is an extremely low total.
But before then, wait, can we talk about your hydroplane credentials? We've talked about burger credentials today. I like to argue that you're the foremost expert in the entire world about hydroplanes.
This is not accurate.
Top 1%, though?
I mean, it's possible that I rank higher among hydroplane like enthusiasts than like basketball experts, just because there's so many more people who pay attention to basketball than there are that pay attention to hydroplane. It's racing, so that's definitely possible.
What about WNBA? You probably rank higher in WNBA,
too. No, I'm my WNBA.
You've fallen off?
Yeah. It's not the same anymore.
You've changed.
I know. I've sold out on the WNBA.
But so you're the top tier of experts of unlimited hydroplane racing.
I will frequently stream other races. We go to these two. I go to these two races every year in the Tri-Cities in Seattle. You have stopped going to Seafair because of the fact that it is such an insane pain in the ass to go to Seafair.
It's an unbelievably horrible experience.
It is the worst. If it wasn't for like my diehard commitment, and also the fact that like, look, can we talk frankly here for a second?
Oh, you kind of move the microphone away from your mouth. This might be off the record.
Every year there's a chance it might be the last unlimited hydroplane race at Seafair.
Ah, yes.
Which has been going on since 1950.
I want to come back to that later. I want to talk about this year's event first, and then the future of unlimited hydroplane racing after.
So what we did see over in the Tri-Cities, I mean, mostly me, because you missed the first set of heats getting there late.
Well, also, I mean, the first set of heats were on Saturday.
Yes, that's true. I didn't go to heats 1 and 2. Was some incredibly competitive racing.
Heats are races, by the way.
That is true. And so what they have is they'll have 4 basically rounds of races. And in each round, there'll be 2 sections where boats get drawn into different sections so that you get slightly different matchups each time, basically, is the idea. And then at the very end, you take the 6 boats who have accumulated the most points through those earlier preliminary races. In this case, the only 6 boats that were still left running and is potentially 1 trailer boat behind them who starts behind them. And then that's kind of a winner take all final.
There's a war of attrition in this week's in the Tri-Cities.
Well, I mean, none of the boats the 2 boats that were lost weren't real contenders. So the top boat on the circuit.
And all of those races are equally as uninteresting.
No, I mean, there were cases where they were competitive a couple of laps in, not the final so much. So the top boats on the circuit this year, you've got the U1 Home Street Bank, which is also...
Is it Home Street Bank everywhere or just in the Northwest?
Everywhere.
Wow, look at that.
Yeah, it's a nationwide sponsorship. And that's also... That boat is owned by the city of Madison, Indiana, which hosts one of the 4 or 5 remaining races on the circuit at this
point.
And
it turns out is not Madison, Wisconsin.
No, you thought that last week. You were very confused about that. Despite plenty of context clues to the contrary.
And also in a Pelton Cast interview that I did not listen to.
So Jimmy Shane, one of our hometown favorites, many of these drivers reside in the Puget Sound area.
I mean, that's kind of the amazing thing about this sport is how many people... It'd be like if the NBA was just made up of, like, Jamal Crawford and Brandon Roy and Isaiah Thomas.
What an amazing dream that would be. Hey, good luck, you know, good luck to the crossover against the Drew League Wednesday night in LA. I considered trying to... I'm going to LA, by the way. I'm going to be on the jump this Friday.
What?
Breaking that news.
You're breaking that right here?
Yeah.
For the no one who's still listening? The listener's gone?
Exactly.
The no one who's still interested in this hydroplane coverage after like an hour and a half?
The 2 people, the 1 listener who's crossover NBA and hydroplane racing, very excited about that news. So I considered moving my
you should
trip
try
off.
You should try when you're on the jump to just talk about hydroplane racing.
It's not what they, I'm here they for. Should...
Wait, who's the host of The Jump right now?
Amin Alhassan.
Okay, so when Amin asks you a question, you should just be like, that's very interesting, but I'd like to talk about hydroplane racing. And then launch into a really long monologue about the future of hydroplane racing.
Anyway, though, there's some rumors that Drew League versus crossover game may not happen due to Jamal Crawford potentially being banged up. So I didn't feel like I could move up my trip on the chance.
Okay, so Jimmy Shane is like the Jamal Crawford of hydroplanes.
So he's a resident of the Kent area. Like he's nearby us. Wow. As we record this podcast.
We should maybe go to his house after this.
Yeah. So that's the defending high points champion from last year. Had won four races in a row in the Tri-Cities before last week when he was upset in the final. The other leading contenders, you've got the Les Schwab boat driven by Andrew Tate, who won last year at Seafair. A legacy driver, the son of Mark Tate, who was a prominent driver during the 1990s and early 2000s.
Uh-huh.
So that was the fastest qualifier last week in the Tri-Cities, but then a little bit of a disappointing final, I guess I would say.
A bad final. Yeah. I mean, I would say that I guess I'm cheering for Andrew Tate, if I'm cheering for anybody.
I don't know. You should probably be cheering for Jimmy Shane since he's from here.
Okay.
And then the other main...
He's like the Isaiah Thomas. Not like Jamal Crawford. He's the Isaiah Thomas of hydroplane racing.
The other main contender, J. Michael Kelly, and the Graham Trucking boat, which was purchased this year by Rob Graham, who has sponsored this boat previously as Graham Trucking, and he got the win on Sunday. And, you know, what had happened... So J. Michael Kelly is notorious for kind of being very aggressive in trying to get the inside lane, which is very important in a race on the water.
Shouts to John Theriot.
Yeah. And had gotten penalized in both heats 3 and 4 because of his attempts to get the inside lane. In the final, decided to change strategies, let everybody else duke it out for the inside lane, and come from the outside at the timed start when the clock ticks down to zero, with, you know, great boat speed from the outside, which he managed to do, beat everyone down to the turn, eventually was able to move over inside and then pull away with the victory.
Has J. Michael Kelly always been so aggressive?
Yeah, pretty much.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
We just didn't notice because he wasn't driving as good of a boat? Or...
He didn't always have the boat to do it, yeah. But he's always been, you know, that's always been his strategy, is to really try to get that inside lane, which is most, that's a lot of, the race is basically determined most of the time by the start.
In the first
based
turn.
On who gets the inside lane and who comes to the start with, you know, good speed and on time. So then the fourth boat that we can probably put into that field of contenders, I would say, this weekend.
I can't believe we're talking about this.
Is the Oberto boat.
Oh, and they're going to be, they were not participating in the Tri-Cities.
They did not. The only race they are scheduled at this point to attend is Seafair. And that's another hometown boat, obviously Oberto, based here, has sponsored boats for many years, including they were the sponsor of the Madison boat before Home Street took
Interesting.
Over.
Interesting. And that's going to be to driven by whom?
So that's
going
to be driven by Burien's own J.W. Myers.
Ah, is J.W. Myers a good enough driver to be, is it a competitive boat?
It should be. I mean, it's been kind of a wild card because they only usually race in the Washington races, and it's a boat with a lot of speed, but, you know, the results have tended to be inconsistent. Last year, John Theriot, as you mentioned, was driving it, and he's a very kind of all-or-nothing style of driver. J.W. Myers, a little more conservative. He drove this boat previously with... So it's owned by the Elstrom family, which is owns a local manufacturing firm, and I think their product is called Elam. That's what they named it. The boat was named previously.
Hydroplane makes you familiar with a lot of fringe products from the Northwest.
It's true. So there's definitely a chance for them to be competitive. I think those are the four boats that really have a reasonable chance.
They haven't raced in
this week.
Any other races.
Nope.
This is it.
J.W. Myers drove.
What's the boat doing?
What is it doing?
It's just sitting there.
Yeah, I mean, they're working on it in the shop.
Okay.
Yeah. And most of these teams have shops generally throughout the Seattle area.
Yeah. So weird. Really. Stretching from Seattle all the way to Auburn. Would you say that Oberto is probably the fan favorite boat?
So people like the Oberto sponsorship, but people have generally hated the Elam has been kind of the villainous team. Deep legendary driver who had the most wins but was not real popular among fans drove the Elam for a long period of time.
Is he also from the Northwest?
Yeah.
And we probably should have liked him.
Yeah, I mean, we were rooting for people who were from the... I guess Steve David, who was the driver of the
not even
Oberto
from the Northwest.
For many years, he is not from the Northwest.
Wow.
A more likable personality. So I don't know if we want to get in. I mean, that's the main boats you need to know.
Those are the main boats you need to know. Okay, so going into this weekend, this is going to be the first Seafair that is not televised since...
I'm not sure. I think it was televised the first year, so I think it's the first one that's not televised ever.
What year was the first year?
1950.
That was on TV?
I think so.
Wow!
I mean, I don't know that for sure, but...
And what's the guy from Schicksal?
No, I can't remember his name off the top of my head either. The legendary KJ, Pat O'Day.
And Pat O'Day was calling that first boat race in 1950.
I don't know if he was calling it.
This is the first time it hasn't been on TV since 1950?
I mean, again, I'm not sure about that.
Wow, that's a much bigger travesty than I thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning.
We were talking about 66 years this was on TV?
Yeah.
Wow.
Hydroplanes were, let's see.
Pat O'Day has been clean 30 years since then.
That is true. Yeah, live TV broadcast. Oh, since 1951. Okay, so I guess it wasn't the first year. It was the second year.
Wow.
Also, it was the year mom was born.
And she's old.
Her entire life, the hydroplane races have been televised. Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising in a way. First off, hydroplane racing is not a great television sport, despite the fact that this has been done for such a long period of time. And then... I think you also look at the changing Seattle. The transplants to the city are not...
Dark in Seattle.
Don't have the same history with hydroplane racing that those of us who grew up here did. And there's a generational aspect to it. I mean, the interesting thing is you still see lots of people attend the races. And in particular, what strikes me attending the races is how diverse the crowd is.
Uh-huh.
So... You know, it's not the people who are moving to Seattle to work at Amazon are not paying any attention to the hydroplane races. But there is like this whole community of like the people from the South End who still, I think, are at least willing to come out and attend the races. But what, as I said earlier, I would not be surprised if this is the last year for unlimited hydroplane racing there.
Wow.
Because the focus has been much more on the air show and even some of the limited hydroplane classes, smaller boats that are not as fast as the unlimiteds.
But are cheaper to run, why would they still be running?
Right. Much cheaper to run.
Are people interested in watching those?
Not to the same extent, but again, people are mostly coming for the air show. So one of the other things that happened, I'm not sure if this is because of the end of TV or whether it precipitated the end of TV, but so when we were kids, there would be the three sets of heats all on Sunday and then the final. Mm-hmm. And you'd also have...
We'd walk in, the circus would flip.
I mean, that was in the Tri-Cities.
Was that in the Tri-Cities?
Yeah. Now, for the past few years, they've moved one of those sets of heats to Saturday so that they can also sell tickets for Saturday and then two on Sunday in the final. This year, they will be having two sets of heats on Saturday and only one set of heat plus the final race on Sunday. That's it.
Why are you even going?
Tradition.
There's not a lot of racing happening.
Yeah, it's...
They didn't add a fourth set of heats?
Nope.
Wow!
I mean, they're trying to clear as much space for the air show as possible. So
how
the
much
Blue
air
Angels
show? Okay, the Blue Angels, I understand. But what is the other part of the air show that anybody else is interested in?
I don't know.
I mean, I just barely understand Blue Angels.
The Blue Angels are... You know, they're one of the few things that I still appreciate in the same way that I did as, like, a six-year-old.
I'm trying to think of things that I
hydroplane racing doesn't even fall under that same category because I...
You're
I
much was, more advanced with your...
Yeah, I was not following it the same way back then.
So the interesting thing about our fandom of hydroplane racing is that we only care about the unlimited hydroplanes.
Yes.
We have no interest whatsoever. It's not like we're fans of boats racing, right?
No.
I could care less about any other boats racing except for the best possible boats racing.
I mean, my argument is like it's like minor league baseball. Like, you're not interested in the Rainiers, really.
Even if there were... Okay, let's say that Alex Rodriguez is playing for the Rainiers or something. Right? Let's say that a really good player is playing for the Rainiers. I would be interested to watch them because of what it would mean for their impact on the future in Major League Baseball.
Right.
I don't care at all. There could be the best future driver driving these other boats, but I would not care at all. There is nothing that could be done to make me care about hydroplanes that are not the unlimited hydroplanes.
Yeah.
Literally nothing. Even if, okay, so people know.
What if a family member was driving one?
Be a stretch. I guess I would cheer for that family member.
Okay.
But, or a Peltoncast listener.
Yeah. There you go. The listener.
The listener or a hydroplane. It's more likely that Lord listens to this podcast.
I disagree with that. There's a lot of blind or flight drivers from the Seattle area. There's an outside chance.
But it's kind of crazy how little we care about anything that is not. And also, you care about the Blue Angels, but I don't care at all about the Blue Angels.
That is correct.
So this event on Sunday, there are two races that I would care about through the first turn before they're over. And then the final.
Yep.
And how much? This event is like $40.
I'm not sure what general admission is.
It's a lot.
Okay.
It's at least $30. It's almost the cost of a Jay-Z ticket.
Yeah, it's...
To go see fucking hydroplanes and an air show?
You know, worst case scenario, you're sitting out looking at the water on a nice
day. You're only looking at the water. You can't even go in the water.
You can occasionally. Very small periods.
Man, I just am not surprised that this event is failing.
I don't think the event is failing. I think the H1 Unlimited series is failing at this point. The limited number of boats, the limited number of events, all of it. Very troubling for the future, which has long been in jeopardy.
Are other people interested in the other boats?
No, I mean, I don't think that there's a group of people who's like exclusively interested in the smaller classes of boats. It's just, as you mentioned earlier, they are much cheaper to run and have figured out better finances. So these, I mean, something else we should discuss. And if you don't know anything about hydroplanes, it's amazing that you have stuck through this point.
I'm so sorry.
So for a long period of time, they operated using... I think old like World War II era military propeller plane engines, like Allison and Rolls-Royce Griffin engines. Mm-hmm. That was
I saw a Mel Gibson movie about that.
Yeah, those were the those were the power plants through the heyday of hydroplane racing, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and all the way into the 80s. And then in the 80s, you started seeing the turbine engines, which come from the Chinook CH-47 helicopter is what they were originally designed for use for. And those now are almost entirely standard in the Unlimited ranks, except for one boat that still uses the old piston-powered engine, which is what all the lower classes use. And they're much louder. And fans of a certain age really associate that sound. The term thunderboat is something that has been applied to hydroplanes, which is now not accurate for the turbine engines, which are much quieter, which is actually really great as a viewing experience because you cannot hear yourself think when those piston boats are all out there on the course together. But
I just like the term fans of a certain age.
Anyways, the point is those are really expensive to run. Like all the equipment that's involved, and you're at risk of the boat flipping over and crashing, or there was a couple boats that hooked and suffered damage as they were turning. There was a boat, I forget who's sponsoring it this year, but the U-21 driven by Brian Perkins, another Southend native, lost a propeller, like part of the, one of the blades of the propeller broke off and took out the rudder, suffered severe damage last week in the Tri-Cities. They're working hard to get it ready to go this weekend for a Seafair. But basically, you have all this incredibly costly damage that occurs. It's a really bad sport financially.
Well, to me, the biggest issue was in our day, right, when we were kids and would go to these hydroplane races in the early 90s, right? The main thing about it was these sponsors that we could identify with.
Yeah, you had national sponsors.
National sponsors.
Kellogg's Frosted
who
Flakes.
Who would be there at every single race.
Budweiser, and, of course, the Miss Budweiser was the most famous hydroplane for a long period of time.
More so than us, it was people who were a little bit rougher around the edges, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, beer and tobacco were key demographics.
And we loved those boats. We loved our beer and tobacco boats.
I mean, the thing is, though, people remember it is more like that than it was.
You're wrong.
I mean, there was always a handful of boats in that era that were getting sponsors week to week in local companies.
But there were no, right now, there are no boats that have a consistent national sponsor that is as big of a company as something like Budweiser.
I mean, Alberto was the close.
Yes.
You actually would see national TV ads.
But also, Alberto is still pretty much a local company.
No, I don't think so. They have national TV.
It's not even close to Budweiser, right?
No, they are not as ubiquitous as Budweiser.
And obviously. So when you had these battles between Budweiser and Winston Eagle, right? Are Winston cigarettes, do they still exist?
I assume they must.
It was like, and then Camel cigarettes. It was part of Camel cigarettes, right?
No, that was a change in sponsorship.
Oh, really? They weren't the same company?
No.
No. But you had Budweiser, Winston Eagle, and then Frosted Flakes. What were some of the other ones?
The Tide.
Oh, yeah. All these kind of disparate companies who just decided to be interested in hydroplane racing, right? And you could identify with these companies in a strange sort of way.
Yeah.
And now you're asking me, we're talking about what the boats are that are racing, and I don't even know what the sponsor is. When I was a kid, I would only know what the sponsor was. And now I only am familiar with the drivers.
Yeah.
Because I see them when I'm doing my banking.
At Home Street? Should get them as a sponsor.
Of the Pelton cast? Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the bigger issue financially is really somewhat less about sponsorships and more about the race sites having a difficult time making enough money to give, you know, large appearance fees to the various boats. That's what I think is really hurting.
Well, and also right now with TV going away, I don't know how they make money.
I mean, TV really hasn't been a big factor for them for a long period of time. Back in the 90s, they used to be tape delayed and they'd run several months later on ESPN.
And I would watch those.
Oh, yeah. It was a lot of fun. Definitely. The nice thing is almost all of those are on YouTube now. So you can watch a tremendous amount of 90s hydroplane racing if you want. I'm going to be up
until 5 a.m. today.
Good luck with that.
But so can this be streamed this weekend, Seafair?
I think that, yes, they are streaming it on h1unlimited.com. I'm not 100% sure about it. It's not something I've worried about that much since, obviously, I will be there. So,
well, if you happen to be...
It will be streamed on CairoTV.com.
So do they have an actual broadcast?
It looks like it.
Okay. Well, that's good. So if you happen to be at Seafair this weekend, please make sure to heckle. You'll be heckle Kevin. He'll be the one who looks very uncomfortable.
I'll be the one with the notebook writing down the points
taking
results.
Stats. Yeah. Doing hydroplane stats.
That broke you. Finally, that broke you. Yep.
Any other thoughts on unlimited hydroplane racing?
Well, I hope they can figure something out because it's still... the Seafair weekend to me is still the high point of the Seattle summer.
And Blue Angels have to come. It's you and this beer.
I got to tell you, not a huge fan of the beer.
Yeah, it was not great.
Yeah.
The ginger beer is much better.
Much better.
On that note, no one's listening right now.
I went and watched the Blue Angels come and land on Monday.
Oh, did you? Yeah, they flew over our house.
Yeah.
Babies were very excited.
I bet they were. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah.
I'm going to be watching them on Friday from Seahawks practice.
Yeah, that's going to be quite an exciting day. That's like the best practice to go to of the year.
95 degrees.
That's not going to be so exciting. Yeah, I'm going to LA and it's going to be much cooler there. Substantially cooler.
It's going to be 95 degrees with the Seahawks flying over, watching Seahawks practice.
Flying over. Wow.
Yeah, they're going to be flying over too. Look, the defense is jacked up. I'm going to be writing down notes about who's playing on the offensive line, who appears to be on the starting offensive line.
Good. Yeah. I look forward to you tweeting that. I'll check that out. All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.